is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for the Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoirish. I like that. It's you know, the story, Go Back to Where You Came From, is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, huh, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And huh, all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents, being Pakistani immigrant parents, very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up, because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? Eh. And they said, eh, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being the shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or the encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
A running theme through the book is, you know, you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama. Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist, who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color, who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden we became us and them, you know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight from that moment on, me, Wajhat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
We're talking to Wajhat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. You can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajhat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. Like, what do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day. And I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it. And people of color are so used to it. But there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh, my God. This happens to you every day? Wow. How would I respond? And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or, do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, you know, second generation, your kids, third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day, but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right, where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. But you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look, quote unquote, white. Again, a social construct, even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look, quote unquote, white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because Black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness, ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality? Or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday at 11 and Sunday at 8 on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajahat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to LA, and an agent says, hey, maybe as the Pakistani American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?
Yeah. And I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end. And I'm like, wait, you're serious? And he said, yeah, Americans like Ted Danson. I'm like, who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels, but this is a story about a Pakistani-American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man who goes, well, think about Ted Danson. And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders, I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a Black man, said, listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that. And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's with a foreword by Hasan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajahat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2, and my wife and I have this conversation all the time, is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially which is under assault right now in America and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. Even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There is a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful. And I was like, no, everything we've done for 5 years, it's failure. And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful. But this is who you are. So when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly, because oftentimes we're having this conversation, and, oh, my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them. We treat them with intelligence and sensitivity, and they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoiled the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam that's, yeah, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times, because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer. And now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob. You know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life. And, you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic. But, you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived. and she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zahir, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Yeah. Just that was his first question. And the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy? But he said, hey, when can I give blood again? Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, you have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky.
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know, how can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, I'm nobody, Waj. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board. Run for city council. You know, go out to a church. Do interfaith. Give money to the right candidates. In your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we could only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for The Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Not all that long ago, when you went on a vacation, you probably sent a postcard to mom, dad, a close friend. Maybe you grabbed one with a photo of the place you were visiting, wrote a quick note on the back. Maybe "Wish You Were Here" was featured on there, slapped on a really cheap stamp. A few days later, it gets delivered. The recipient gets excited with that fun piece of mail, and they get to read the personalized note. Maybe they even saved it and put it in a box. But now that we have smartphones and easy access to email and social media, are postcards still relevant? Our next guest says yes. She's got a new book coming out on the history of postcards, all the different industries that are involved with making them happen, the role they played in the past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still send postcards? Why or why not? How do you feel when you get them, if you do? Is there a particular postcard you remember sending or receiving? Do you have that treasure trove, a box of your own or someone else's postcards? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Pine is an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned that treasure trove, that box of postcards, maybe from a family member. You had one of those, right?
Yes. I started this project with one of those boxes. And since I've been working on this project, have been gifted with several more. Excuse me. It seems that the once family members find out that you're interested in the postcard project, they keep coming. They recirculate, if you will, which is awesome. But yes, my interest in this project really was sparked by having been gifted this box of postcards from the turn of the 20th century and looking through postcards that my great-grandfather had received and just sort of starting to think about all of the different ways that postcards function as a social network.
You write that postcards are the largest class of artifacts that humankind has ever exchanged. Can you give us a sense of the scope, especially in the heyday of the postcard?
Yeah, that it really shocked me to realize just how many postcards have been made and sent and printed and read and received going around the world. So historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920, something like 200 billion, so billion with a B, postcards were in global circulation. And when I came across that, that really set me back to just think about just the sheer amount of work and labor and ideas and technology that go into all of the parts that are required to send a postcard. As you said, we have to find a stamp. We have to have it delivered. We have to print it. We have to buy it and send it, and somebody has to receive it. And thinking about 200 billion artifacts in circulation was really mind-blowing for me.
You dig into the meaning of postcards, what it means that we embrace these and sent them. And there's a tip here in your subtitle, our first social network. Can you talk about that idea of sending these cheap postcards, quick, cheap, easy to send, as a sort of social network?
Yeah, one of the things that has been fascinating to dig into with this project is the idea that there's a sender and a recipient. And it's not just sort of performative tourism of, oh, look, here I am, I sent this postcard, and here's my demonstration that I went to this really cool touristy thing. But there's also the sort of material life of the postcard, that it's received. Some people save them, some people don't save them. And there's this sense that that postcards are forming the lines of networking that I think we reenact over a century later with digital social networks like Twitter and Instagram. The idea that there's a post and that people respond to it, or the idea that that there's an image and that it sort of has this sense, like there's a really good sort of Instagram aesthetic. There were really good postcard aesthetics 100 years before. And so I think that there are a lot of the similar ways that social networks function that we think about today. A lot of the precedents for this were set down by this older social network made up of postcards.
One thing that really struck me, I think of postcards mainly as, you know, the thing you send when you travel. They were big in rural America as kind of this lifeline of communication. Can you talk about how it swept rural communities across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story. So in 1909, the U.S. Post Office was in danger of going bankrupt, that they were something like $17 million in the red, and it was really quite grim. And 2 years later, in 1911, they're actually running a surplus. They're running something like $200,000 of a surplus. And there's this huge question of, well, what happened? What happened in 2 years that could turn around the postal situation like that? And the historian Daniel Gifford had gone through the postal archives to figure out that it's simply the sheer number of postcards that are being bought and sold and sent through the United States Postal Service at that point. And so, excuse me. And so one of the big ways that this really turned was it was establishing connections between rural people in rural America with people in urban America. And so there is this sort of networking effect that's happening.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book out next week, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, David?
Just kind of neat. I was going through my dad's stuff, you know, right down to the fishing tackle and the last of the stuff. He passed a while ago. And one of the things that was in there, it was a cardboard, I'd call it a can, and it had like a tin top and a tin bottom to it. And I opened it up, and there was a postcard inside, and it said, send your used gold here, and you know, they would buy it back for 35 cents an ounce or whatever, but there was a penny postcard in there, so that had to be like from the 30s or 40s maybe. So
wow.
I just thought that was kind of cool with the penny postcard, though.
Interesting, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Lydia, a lot of postcards were sent for personal communication. A lot of them, you write, were for advertising or business schemes like the one David's dad, it sounds like, ran across.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with that.
Yeah.
I'm so excited that David had that example to share, because certainly postcards were an incredibly cheap form of advertising. And lots of companies did things like that to advertise either personal businesses or to advertise for their company. And it really was fairly ubiquitous. One of my favorite examples that I folded into the introduction of the book was a postcard that was sent out by a church in Kansas that was reprimanding people for not attending services. And so this idea that there's advertising or there's some sort of like, not just, hey, wish you were here, that there's certainly that element to postcards as well.
Yeah, our producer Bill Martin's liked to one that you printed saying, hey, we all felt bad you didn't make the Sunday school last Sunday. Hope to see you next week.
Exactly.
The guilt card. I love it. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Madeline in Rice Lake. Madeline, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share a little story of my parents and I, before I got married, my parents and I took a last trip of me being single, and we went across Lake Michigan in the SS Badger ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And in the gift shop, they had a thin little wooden postcard. And I thought, I want to send this to my fiance. And it was so cute. I wrote a little letter, and it was such a cute little postcard. I told him, hang on to this, because when we're married and we have our little home, like, I would like to have this as decor. And I have it now in a little cabinet tucked away, kind of cute.
I love it, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing that. A lot of
wonderful
sentimental value, Lydia, not just for Madeline, but for a lot of people on maybe that particular postcard.
No, exactly. That there really is this sort of resonance in it. And it's not just building any kind of network. It's really building this personal network and this personal connection. And it's sort of like this material manifestation of, hey, here's this thing. And I remember doing this thing. So that's a brilliant example.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the history and the present of postcards with Lydia Pine. She's an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send and or receive postcards to this day? Do you have fond memories of doing it in the past? Do you have a collection of your own or maybe a family member's in a box? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lydia Pine about her newest book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Fountain City. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
Years ago, a very good friend of mine started a postcard chain letter idea. And he set up groups that you could pick a theme, and you would get postcards from all over the world, all over the country. I got a huge stack of them, and it was a great, fun project.
And, John, have you gotten some ones from around the world?
Oh, yeah, from all over Europe, Africa, Soviet Union in those days.
I love it, John. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Lydia, you have been on a postcard sending mission, I understand, as part of your research for the book.
For part of the research for the book, but also just out of, I loved sending and receiving postcards as a kid and decided that I wanted to do the same with my nieces and nephews, who are thoroughly in the Gen Z demographic. And it was this utter novelty when I started doing it a couple of years ago when I started this research project. And it's been really fun for the kids to receive and to start sending them. That's been the other fun thing to sort of build the network back the other way, is to be able to have them start sending some postcards to me as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We had an email from Greg who says his father passed away some years ago, was an avid postcard collector. Greg says he's held on to his collection, not knowing what to do with it, apart from a few he wants to personally keep. He wonders, you know, can you get these appraised? Or can you sell these things or at a minimum donate them so that someone can enjoy them as much as his dad did? There is, a collector's market, but there's a lot of postcards out there, right, Lydia?
There are a lot of postcards out there. I know that some public libraries are interested in collections and just sort of building their own picture archives. Some historical associations are interested in building those. Some folks opt to sort of disassemble personal collections like that through eBay or Etsy. So I think that those seem to be the most popular, the popular options for what to do with the collection if you don't want to keep the shoebox.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I called in postcards are really important to me. And as an art teacher and an art therapist, I use postcards a lot. But here's one thing. In talking to a friend of mine, we haven't lived near each other since we were 18, but have known each other for 59 years now. And she just told me that she has saved every single postcard and letter I have ever written to her.
Aww.
And so, it's like, and I remember writing a lot of those postcards from, you know, family vacations all the way up until taking our kids on family vacations, you know, and I stopped sending them too much these days, but still send them once in a while. So anyway, she's got my life in a shoebox.
Susie, thank you so much. That reminds me, Lydia, a big point you make is, you know, a postcard on a shelf is one thing, but it really becomes something based on, you know, what we do with it, who we send it to, the message we write, and what they do with it when they get it.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really interesting about this project is the sense that I tell people about it, and the first thing folks say usually is, well, does anybody send postcards anymore? And the answer is emphatically yes, people do send postcards. So for example, in the last couple of elections, postcards to voters have been really popular. There are programs that you can arrange to have postcards sent on your behalf. People still send them sort of almost in defiance of fast communication to say, look, here, we can celebrate the slowness of a postcard. And so it's really neat to see people, I think, embracing the qualities that postcards offer. They don't offer the speed of an Instagram post, but they offer sort of that material connection. The idea that here's this thing and it took this effort and I thought of you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Amanda next in De Pere. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I like to use the cheesy postcards from the 80s, draw pictures on them, and write jokes for my 6-year-old nephew and send them through the mail. And he just loves the surprise when the postman brings it.
Is this something you've been doing over the COVID time?
Definitely during the COVID time. And he's just learning how to read. He's in kindergarten. So it's a great way for him to practice those letters.
I love it, Amanda. Thanks a lot for telling us about that. Lydia, what do you think of the story?
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that there's a huge historical precedent for it. Not only is it just really cool and an amazing thing to be doing, but you're tapping into this sort of 150 years of postcards to do it.
Thanks, Amanda, for sharing that with us. We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now. We've got Paul with us in Toma. Paul, hello. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. What's you had a story for us, I think, Paul. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah. Well, when my son was in Cub Scouts way back in the mid 90s, I started a program, helped him do a program for his national requirement for one of his badges. And what we did is we sent out postcards to all 50 governors and had them sign a card and send it back to us that said peace through cooperation. It was because back in the day, presidents became presidents either being governors, senators, or congressmen. But as a result, like I said, he got 47 out of 50.
Wow!
And the three only three of them didn't respond. because we were outside of the state. That was back when we were in Louisiana. So,
well, I got to ask, did you keep those or did he keep those?
We did for a very long time. Then I became homeless for a while and I had them with me and they got lost to the wind. But they were quite the collection. We had Mario Cuomo back in the day, and we had we got a letter from President-elect Clinton, and we got one from the replacement governor of Arkansas, and several of the governors were either died within a year or were convicted.
Thanks a lot. I'm sorry you ran into hard times and had to give those up, but a great story still, Lydia. I love that, writing to public officials and getting responses from most of them.
That's fantastic. I think it really speaks to sort of the ubiquity and the flexibility of postcards as a medium, to be able to have all of these different ways for postcards to be sent and received and to have them intersecting people's lives. I love it.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. We've got Dick on the line in La Crosse now. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember postcards. I was a little farm boy in Iowa back in the 50s. And I would get a postcard from my grandparents who would travel to California, and I would get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, or when they went to Mount Rushmore, it would be Mount Rushmore. And so it was the best pictures I ever saw of those kind of historical figures from throughout the states when they traveled. And so I just thought that was very special to have them think of me, but I also got to see something that they saw that was kind of an icon.
I love it, Dick. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm also glad he called, Lydia, because you reminded me. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how places are represented in these postcards that people like Dick's grandparents were sending.
Oh, that's a fantastic segue. And there are two things that come to mind with that. One, certainly there are these famous places like Mount Rushmore or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or things like that that become really codified as tourist stops. Through postcards. It's like, hey, I went to this place and I am going to send you this postcard of this famous thing. But there's also, in the early 20th century, postcards are also serving a role in sort of early photojournalism, where real picture postcards that are basically just pictures that are printed on postcard stock are a alternative or an option for the sort of early days of photojournalism. And so for things like the Mexican Revolution or for political rallies and protests and things like that of the early 20th century, postcards become a way of dissembling and being able to sort of make people aware of places and of things that are happening there.
Just in our last minute, you know, 20 years from now, we're not going to open up that box of Instagram posts. Do you worry that we're losing something if a lot of that kind of a quick communication is in this non-physical form that postcards were?
That's an interesting question. And I would say yes and no. That, yes, yeah, certainly, I hope that nobody's printing out my Instagram posts to save the way, I would hope that people would save a postcard. But I also look at how many postcards have been lost, right? That we don't have those 200 billion postcards still with us. And so I think that there will be some things that sort of filter through and are saved. And that's pretty neat.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Pine, affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Love to hear more of your postcard stories. You can share them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe even you can share a picture of one that you've kept or found in that treasure trove from a relative. Again, you can share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we'll have more stories to share later this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.